This is Due South on WUNC. I'm Leonita Inge, and we're at the Crowsdale Country Club in Durham for a very special event hosted by the Duke Campus Club. Welcome. Well, this is the multicultural Southern food experience. Over the course of the next hour, I'll be talking with three North Carolina chefs about their cookbooks, the diversity in the food they prepare, and how that has shaped their professional paths. Sandra Gutierrez is an acclaimed food journalist, a professional cooking instructor, and a regular judge for the James Beard Awards. She is the author of 5 cookbooks, including The New Southern Latino Table and Latissimo, home recipes from the 21 countries of Latin America. Sandra, welcome to Due South. Nancy McDermott is a cooking teacher and the author of 14 cookbooks, including the Wok and Skillet Cookbook, 300 recipes for stir fries and noodles. Her passion is researching and celebrating traditional food from Asia and the American South. Nancy is a Piedmont, North Carolina native and was a Peace Corps volunteer in northeastern Thailand. Nancy, welcome.
So good to be here.
And Ryan Mitchell has been cooking Eastern Carolina-style whole hog barbecue for most of his life. I don't think he had a choice. He's a pit master from Wilson, North Carolina, and the son of barbecue legend Ed Mitchell. He and his father recently published their first cookbook together titled Ed Mitchell's Barbecue. He and his father, Ed, are also co-founders of True Made Foods. Ryan, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, each of you has ties to the American South and to Southern foodways, so I'd love to start by asking you all what flavors like best describe your personal connection to this region. Sandra.
I would say barbecue, for sure.
Really?
I cannot go there without talking about barbecue. But I would say also grits for me has been pivotal and base. My basic love for Southern food started with my first taste of grits, which reminded me of masa, of the hominy that we use in Latin America to make so many products. And then I would say anything sweet, cloyingly sweet, like caramel cake and pie. Yes, pecan pie. I think our love of sugar is also very common, both between the South and Latin America. So that would be the second thing. And my third thing, which might surprise you, but it's actually one of the most important ingredients in the South, is mayonnaise. I think of deviled eggs. I think of shrimp salad. I think of all those delicious remoulades and sauces that we use. And I think that's probably one of the least expected ingredient, and yet one of the most important. And yes, Duke's mayonnaise only, please.
Well, that makes me think of my friend Bill Smith, you know, a Crook's Corner. He used to come by the station by WUNC every summer and bring us tomato and mayo sandwiches. I miss that, Bill.
Yes.
I hope you're listening. Okay, Nancy.
Well, I'm thinking of summer coming and a southern summer garden. And my southern summer garden is farmers markets. I don't have that much of a green thumb. I like to have a few things going, but the sweet corn and sliced tomatoes, cucumbers, okra. I just love that. I remember at my grandmother's dairy farm in the summertime, we would have vegetable plate for lunch and just be all, you know, the sliced tomatoes really shine. And that, and then, of course, all the sweet things, and nobody can get enough barbecue. That's got to end with that.
So now, Ryan, you got to talk about all the barbecue.
Oh,
you ate and cooked in Wilson.
Christ. So without a doubt, it is apple cider vinegar, right? And Ooh. Eastern North Carolina vinegar-based barbecue sauce, all right? So without a doubt, crushed red pepper, paprika, little S&P, but you know, the most exciting thing about the apple cider vinegar as it relates to our project, we're just learning about its importance of, you know, being more than a condiment. You know, it was used you know, as a antibiotic. It was used as a, you know, for all different types of ailments. It's a multi-purpose, you know, condiment that was used throughout Eastern North Carolina. And it's tied to whole hog chopped barbecue, you know, because the ability to cook the whole animal, it also offers a bit of a tenderizer and much more flavor to it. So that was an important thing to learn, you know, as I've growing up as a kid and working on this project.
You didn't mention watermelon, because I think your grandmother, didn't she make like a watermelon sweet tea or
watermelon
something?
Watermelon sweet tea.
Oh my goodness. I was
like, that sounds good.
Scuppernong.
That's really good.
We use almost every fruit that came out of the backyard as a replacement for sugar. So she would put the fruits in the water and turn that into whatever kind of your that was your Kool-Aid, you know, grapes in the water and sit there long enough and sweeten up. And then, you know, it didn't have to add any sugar or anything else to it. So,
your grandma discovered spa water.
Yes, spa water, right? Cucumbers and oranges have been in our water, you know, for 20 years. That isn't anything new for me. So that was a great experience as well.
You mentioned scuppernongs. I got to jump back in.
Yes.
Wild persimmons, North Carolina persimmons. Yeah. When that season comes in, that's something that I forgot all about, went away, lived other places, and came back and saw persimmon pudding at a farmer's market. And that's old school, and I still love it.
I love persimmon pudding. So maybe we can talk a little bit about when did you actually start cooking, Ryan? I mean, I know you were in a home where everybody else was cooking, and so you could just eat.
Yeah.
But when did you start cooking, and why?
I started cooking, I guess I was about 14 years old. You know, the irony of it all, for me personally, my grandmother wanted me nowhere near the kitchen, you know. So we had a supermarket and a grocery store and a small, you know, restaurant at that time. And, you know, the elders at that time, the way it works is you put the youngest, most innocent grandchild in front of the cash register. Right? So you can ensure that the cash gets where it's supposed to be instead of the grown-ups, right? So she didn't want me anywhere near the kitchen, to be quite honest. It was my dad and my uncles who forced me to the smokehouse. And, you know, that was just my way of really kind of, you know, showing them that I could do a whole lot more than just, you know, count the money and be, you know, doing all the boring stuff on the inside. So I started, you know, spending my days in the smokehouse at about 14 years old. Yep.
Nancy, what about you? I know your passion for Asian cuisine and, you know, just you didn't just start cooking right away, especially, you know, the Asian food that you like to fix, Thai food.
Well, I've loved to cook since childhood. I mean, I had a grandmother who loved to bake and biscuits and coconut cake, all the wonderful goodies that I had growing up, just visiting them and elder relatives and family reunion food. And I just loved to cook anything all through my high school, college days. When I went to Thailand, I really didn't learn to cook. I fell in love with Thai food. I ate. And I was in my early 20s. I didn't think about what I would do when I got home. So I learned to cook Thai food and Asian food. When I came back home to Greensboro, North Carolina, taught school in High Point, and missed Thai food. It was the late 70s. There were not a lot of Thai restaurants. And I had students who were from refugee families from Laos and Cambodia who were moving into the area. Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service resettled a lot of folks from Southeast Asia in this area. And I was teaching junior high, seventh and eighth grade, English and social studies. And I ended up having a little ESL table in my classroom because there were kids coming in who spoke no English. There weren't programs. And I got to know those families and they had gardens. And by then I really wanted to learn to teach. So I went to the Oriental store in Greensboro and got coconut milk, fish sauce, jasmine rice, curry paste and galanga, some herbs, and made chicken coconut soup. And it came out great. And then I thought, okay, I can cook Thai food. So from then on, it was finding ingredients and eventually going back to research when I got my cookbook contract.
Wow. You know, Sandra, you're the only person I think on the panel who was not born and raised in North Carolina. So how did you get here? And and what were some of your early discoveries or observations about any regional foods and dishes?
So yeah, you can tell by my accent, I'm not from Durham, right? But what you don't know is I was born in Philadelphia, so this is my version of a Philly accent. I was 5 years old when my parents, who were Guatemalans, moved back to Guatemala. And my father was an oral surgeon, and my mother was an economist. And I had a grandmother who was a socialite, and she was the Martha Stewart of the 50s, 60s, and 70s in Guatemala. And anybody who was anybody would come to her house on the weekends, and I was a very shy little girl. And in Latin America, you are expected to go into a room, give every single person a kiss on the cheek, and introduce yourself. I would do that, whether there were four people or 40 people, and then I would run and hide in the kitchen. So I started cooking when I was 6 years old.
Wow.
But I got back here to Durham, North Carolina, because I married a wonderful Guatemalan, blonde and blue-eyed Guatemalan, just to break more stereotypes. And he was a student at the Fuqua School of Business. So that's what brought us back to the South. We fell in love with North Carolina. After a short stint in Toronto, Canada, we decided to come back and raise both of our daughters here. So our daughters are two little Southern Latinas who are now very, very old. And our youngest is also a Duke alum. She went to the law school here. So I have my own ties with Duke. So Duke brought me back.
Duke brought you back.
Nice.
Well, we're going to talk more about, you know, food and the discoveries in the region. As soon as we get back, we'll hear more from North Carolina cookbook authors Sandra Gutierrez, Nancy McDermott, and Ryan Mitchell after the break. This is Due South. You're listening to Due South on WUNC. I'm Leonita Inge at the Crowsdale Country Club in Durham. And we're here at the Multicultural Southern Food Experience hosted by Duke Campus Club. I'm here with three local food authors and chefs, Nancy McDermott, Sandra Gutierrez, and Ryan Mitchell, discussing their culture, their cuisines, and their careers. We're here to discuss your work as multicultural cooks, and I'd love for us to spend some time talking about what it's like to occupy that space. So first, are you considered by others to be an authority in your field when it comes to your cuisine of choice, Sandra?
Yes, I am. I'm considered an expert in Latin American cuisines, all 21 of them, but I'm also considered an expert in Southern regional cuisine. And it is extremely special to have a foot on each territory. It makes up for wonderful food and wonderful conversations.
Nancy, what about you?
My expertise is particularly in Thai food, having lived there and spent a lot of time there. But I also have, over the years, just with cooking and researching all over Asia, there's so many similarities. And I think one thing that I bring to the table in the kitchen counter is knowing ingredients. I think when people want to cook a cuisine that is not one they grew up with, there's a great interest, and yet you look in a cookbook and here's an ingredient that you haven't seen before or a technique that you haven't used before. And I think I'm kind of a guide of this is, I've started out in a Western kitchen. This is how I learned how to bring life to some flavors and ingredients and dishes. It's not going to be the same. And it's not going to be the same even as Thailand when I was there many years ago. But it's about introducing people to something that I love and enjoy and saying, here are the ingredients. Here's something you can substitute. Here's an attitude about the food. Because I think when there's something, actually, I find this with baking as well. I write about Southern food, Southern cakes, Southern pies. And a lot of people feel now that baking is hard and I don't know, I'm not good at it. And it's cooking should be for joy and it should be for trying something new and sharing flavors. So whether I'm talking about how to bake a cake or how to make a Thai curry from scratch, I'm always trying to invite people to enjoy it and explore it and not feel like it's a competition because we got enough to worry about. Food should be joyful.
Well, Ryan, what about you? I mean, I guess it's hard to be really an authority with your father looking over your shoulder.
Yes.
I don't know, but I'm sure you found your place now.
I'm the security of the authority himself. But yeah, you know, my father's a Hall of Fame, you know, barbecue legend. But at its core, you know, barbecue is multicultural itself. So we've been fortunate enough to be able to take our love and our passion for the food. And we've cooked. It's taken us to Melbourne, Australia. It's taken us to London, Sao Paulo, Brazil. In a couple of months, I'll be heading over to Lagos, Nigeria. You know, it's just been a joy, you know, to be able to share our passion all over the world.
Taking the show on the road.
you know, to be called an authority, you know, it's a labor of love, quite honestly. So, you know, we embrace that.
So, Ryan, I have to also ask you, you know, what do you think it takes, you know, it's taken to really establish, you know, you and your family as a leader? And that's in, you know, in barbecue or Latin food or Thai food. And really, were you challenged? I mean, to get to the point where you have a cookbook what you do, I mean, that means that a lot of people had to do some homework to make sure you were an authority. But were you challenged? At first, I mean, everybody thinks they can cook barbecue.
we were definitely challenged. But I tell everyone, we didn't enter the barbecue business from the competitive network. We entered the barbecue business strictly from a place of survival. You know, my grandfather passed away. And, you know, we literally had to look around and figure out how we were going to maintain and keep, you know, keep my grandmother functional and paying these bills. On the second page of the dedication page, there's a gentleman named there by the name of Lior Sanders. Lawyer Sanders, sorry. It's my great-grandfather. My great-grandfather fathered 36 children, okay? Two wives, all right? That's the most impressive part of the story. So, first wife had 16. She passed away. The second wife had 20. And she is Beatrice, okay? So from that lineage, from that tangible 150-year legacy in barbecue, we were able to factually point to the cultural narrative that this food and these skill sets played in our family and in our area. So I had to grow up figuring out a way how to, like, not let that go to waste. You know what I mean? And so barbecue became, you know, a very notable thing for us. It, you know, I only give that story just so people understand the level of culture and hospitality that was inside of our home, you know, and that I grew up under as a, you know, younger man, you know. So, you know, that, you know, learning that type of food as a love language from that environment is totally different than just, you know, going out and just cooking on a grill just for fun. Wow. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Yeah.
What about you, Nancy?
I love, Ryan just said food is a love language. And I think for me, when I'm teaching or writing or sharing Thai food or Asian ingredients or things that I learned along the way, it's not from a position of I'm an authority and here's how you do it and this is right and this is wrong. It's my life took me on a journey and I got to learn things and experience things, and I love to share that. And when there's a match between people who are curious about something, maybe they've traveled, maybe they've been to Thai restaurants and they want to just have fun at the table or learn about something. I'm really a seventh and eighth grade social studies teacher grown up. So I'm saying, here are these stories, here's this food, and I'm very oriented toward, if you want to cook it, I can help you with that part of it. Then if you want history, here are books. And if you want to travel, I can, you know, talk about just the thing, just ways to make yourself at home in another place. And I think a lot of us have various variations on that. And, you know, no one is living exactly the life that their grandparents lived or staying in one place. So I feel like I've been able to see things and I want to share that and say, I like this. And if you like it, let me help you enjoy it in your home kitchen.
Sandra, what about you? I think I'd read where maybe you were challenged, but then you had to prove a point here that you know exactly what you're talking about when it comes to Latin cuisine.
Yes, it's very funny that with a last name like Gutierrez, editors and publishers were not interested in Latin American cuisines. I have been, as Nancy is my witness, talking about this book for the past 20 years.
Yes.
And every time I took it to an editor or a publisher, they would say, we're not ready. And I think it was because they were not ready for our voices to be the ones to display our cuisine. The voices of the people who ate the food. If you look at Mexican cuisine, the first authorities were British or American. And here I was, a Latina, pushing the food of all 21 countries. So it was interesting to me that my opportunity to write, I was a food editor for the Carrie News for 8 years. So I interviewed and I wrote about food and ingredient-based cooking. But my interest was to put together books that would teach people, like Nancy says, how to make things easily at home, because I got to see a lot of intimidation in the kitchen and from my cooking students also. So I found it very interesting when it was the University of North Carolina Press, upon seeing my first a proposal on a Latin American book that said, you're talking here about Latin American influences in Southern foodways. We want you to prove that that's a real movement. And if you can prove it, we want a whole book on it. And that was my foray into writing a book. And that's how the new Southern Latino Cookbook was born. And I got to name the movement, the Southern Latino Movement. And the movement made it to the Smithsonian Museum. And now my story is there next to Julia Child's kitchen with some of my kitchen objects. And it was
that's
proven.
That's a good location. Yeah. That's a good location.
No.
For sure.
So I was able to prove it was a real movement. So for me, then writing for the Savor the South collection was my acceptance into Southern foodways, into Southern culture, and it was my welcome home card, if you will, when the University of North Carolina Press said, we have only Southern authors writing books on this collection. If you haven't seen it, it's a beautiful collection. Nancy has a beautiful book on fruit there too. And they said, and we want you to be one of our Southern authors. And I can tell you the emotion I felt that day was as big as when my granddaughter was born. It was, oh my goodness, the South is now my home.
But thank you very much. I'm here with three local food authors and chefs, Sandra Gutierrez, Nancy McDermott, and Ryan Mitchell. We have a question from the audience. What key ingredients should be in my pantry to cook Thai food? But I'm going to expand that. You know, if you could list at least maybe three or so ingredients when we think of if someone attempts to make their own barbecue, or what rub maybe you could suggest, Ryan, and maybe even Sandra. You know, I actually went to a restaurant in Durham not too long ago because I've been here a while, over 20 years, and I've seen the growth in Latin cuisine, like even on every corner. I even find myself going down Roxborough Road, turning on this side street behind whatever, just to go to a food truck to get these best, is it churros?
What are yes, the? Churros.
Yes,
oh,
churros.
That's a fried dough at its
like,
best.
Look, what am I doing? You know? But I will go just about anywhere, you know, to get the best of the best. And I have to bring up Esmeralda's Cafe, where I couldn't almost get a seat in Durham. I don't know if you all have been there, but I'm very excited. So please give me three ingredients, this panel. What? I know we have a lot of eaters out there, but I'm assuming we have some cooks in the audience as well.
I'll start with Thai, since that was the first question. Fish sauce, red curry paste, galanga, which is in the ginger family, and you can find it in Asian markets at in dried or fresh, lemongrass, and then lots of herbs, mint, lots of basil, fresh dill. A lot of the ingredients you can find nowadays. When I came back from Thailand, I had to go to Asian markets for everything. Nowadays, Harris Teeter has so many of the ingredients that you need for Asian cooking, and a lot of it is limes and shallots and garlic.
You still, Nancy, just gave a list too long for me. I mean, now I'm scared. Yeah. I can't fix that the right dish.
But so much of what my first book is called Real Thai, and it was traditional cooking in the traditional way. Of course, for a stove inside, not a charcoal burner like in Thailand. My second was called Quick and Easy Thai. That was about 9 years later, and it was after I had children. And I realized going to five different markets to find the special things is hard. But what if I want to cook Thai food on a weeknight? And it's absolutely possible. There's just a constellation of things. You know, Thai people don't make curry paste from scratch on a weeknight. They'd make a simple stir fry, and that's where this book comes in.
Nice. What's in your pantry, Ryan?
Barbecue is fairly simple. I think the most important ingredient you want to actually have is going to be your relationship with your local small farmer. Sourcing the meat from the highest quality you probably can afford to get it from locally. So I'll start with that. And then as far as any spices, obviously we apple cider vinegar. I have an affinity to that. Kosher salt, coarse black pepper, and smoked paprika, I think, will be my three flavor profiles to go to. Yeah.
What about you, Sandra?
Well, it's interesting. My book, Latinissimo, is divided into ingredients because we don't all eat the same food around Latin America. Not everybody eats tacos, as delicious as tacos are. You ask for a taco in Argentina and you'll get the heel of a shoe or a very, very short man. So you choose what you prefer. So it's not, we don't even speak the same language. But I would say that what makes Latin America so exciting is that we have world ingredients represented in each country in completely different amalgamations depending on where you are. So Nancy mentioned fish sauce, so important in Thai cuisine. I would say you cannot have a Peruvian pantry without fish sauce, soy sauce. You cannot have a Brazilian pantry without having your bulgur for your quibes, which they sell as quipes in the streets of Brazil. And I would say your main ingredients, and you'll be surprised, these are all from the Americas, would be corn. That is the backbone of the Americas. Tomatoes, which are native to Peru, not to Italy. And we ate them first, and we cooked those special sauces first. And I would say cacao or chocolate for you all. That is a Latin American ingredient. And I would say another one that is key for your kitchen are potatoes. And I think none of the ingredients that I've mentioned are not beloved in the South. So as you can see, Latin American food is a way of tasting world flavors with a place in mind that will remind you of home all the time. And so what I was able to prove to these editors and publishers who were not willing to print the book was that armed with a recipe list of 9,000 recipes, and of course you cannot have a book with 9,000 recipes, it would be as tall as this room. I said to them, I had to make the recipe list this long for you to understand that I know what I'm talking about. And this is easy food for the everyday home cook that you can make without having to buy special ingredients that you will not find in your local supermarket because they're all around all of us. And finally, these are the recipes that contemporary cooks just like you who are busy, they work, they come home with kids and they're tired and they want to make dinner quickly in the middle of the week can do. So that was the goal, is to use your pantry as a ways to feed your family quickly, inexpensively, expediently, and with lots of flavor.
Mm-hmm. I was trying to make a list, and maybe I need you all to help me just really some of the, you know, commonalities between the base ingredients that we were just talking about, you know, just how cross-cultural, you know, food is, especially when you get to the South, and it's such a melting pot here now that I think we mix and stir and pour and sprinkle things that we didn't even think about on food.
It's inevitable that we mix food. That is how world food was produced. That is how the first globalization of food happened, when the old world came and quote unquote discovered the new world, and ingredients from both sides of the world collided. And the world's been turning ever since. And that's Italians right. Got tomatoes, and we got cilantro. Latin Americans got cilantro from the Middle East and rice from Spain. And they got our chocolate in Switzerland and et cetera. And how ingredients as simple as hominy which everybody in this room has had how many, is exactly the same ingredient you use to make tortillas and tamales. It's nixtamalized corn. So we're all speaking the same world language through food. It's just different combinations and different spices, but the world of food will never stop blending. We just can't help ourselves.
Food travels. We travel, we take food with us, migration, wars, all sorts of hard and beautiful reasons move people to different places. And like even within Thailand, it's like, oh, peanut sauce. People love satay with peanut sauce. Well, that's from Malaysia. That is something that starts in Indonesia with a very soy sauce-based sauce, and it's always meat because it's a Muslim country. It's always beef and chicken rather than pork because it's a Muslim country. Right. And then it moves up into Malaysia, and they have the little grilled skewers with a peanut sauce. And Thais, that comes up to Thailand, and they say, well, this is really delicious, but we're going to make the sauce a little more hot and chili spicy and tangy, and we're going to use pork because pork is our favorite. So the same dish starts here, travels there, and no one is giving instructions or teaching for this to happen. It's just a natural, it's an evolution, things moving back and forth, and it just, when you travel and you see, this reminds me of that, sometimes it's because this was borrowed, and sometimes it's just, you know, everybody looked at meat and the stick, and it's like, let's put meat on a stick and hold it over a fire. That's no right. one gets credit for that. So it's interesting to talk about where things came from, but a lot of it is spontaneous. Yeah. And I find it so exciting to think, here's this ingredient. What do they do with it here and here and here? And then learn from that.
You know, Nancy, you just mentioned one ingredient, one thing that I really love. You said peanuts. And I think of Bertie County.
Yes.
But I also, I was like, wow, yeah, peanuts. That's pretty cross-cultural. And then I think of Senegal, West Africa, and I think of the peanuts.
Yes. Ground nuts. That's amazing. Peanuts, that's a traveler.
I know, that's a traveler. Well, more on the business and multicultural cooking with Sandra Gutierrez, Nancy McDermott, and Ryan Mitchell after the break. This is Due South.
My sweet tea, what you got cooking? Sure, here's the spot. Peace pie, little ice cream on top. And you know,
you're listening to Due South on WUNC. I'm Leonita Inge. We're spending this hour with three renowned local chefs, Sandra Gutierrez, Nancy McDermott, and Ryan Mitchell. We've been talking about their cooking and their careers. This is a multicultural Southern food experience hosted by the Duke Campus Club at the Crowsdale Country Club in Durham. Thank you. You know, on Due South, I recently talked to another chef, Crystal Wilkinson, whose most recent book is Praise Song for the Kitchen Ghosts, stories and recipes from five generations of country cooks. And she told me, though her work is inspired by recipes handed down from her ancestors, it would be impossible to prepare them exactly as they did, you know, for a number of reasons. First of all, the ingredients, the same utensils are not around. But does any of this really ring true with you? Any kitchen ghosts there?
Can I?
Yes, Sandra.
Absolutely, 100%. When you start researching Latin American foodways and you start looking for recipes and you go back to the 16th century and 17th century and you start reading recipes that say, season the chicken the way you would on Sunday and cook it until it's done. And that's the recipe. So it becomes very interesting finding different cooks, how they prepare the dish, and then coming up with a recipe that you develop among all the differences. It is so classic to find women. I did some Zoom meetings when I had to interview people over the pandemic and I couldn't travel places, and I would get 20 or 25 cooks cooking the exact same dish on a Zoom meeting. And I was able to interview them and talk to them and constantly say, can you please show me the size of your cup? Could you show me your pinch? Could you, because some people were using their grandmother's teacup to measure while somebody else was using an exact measuring cup
three
to
cups.
Measure.
What does that mean?
Exactly. So all of that comes into equation when you're trying to rescue recipes.
The reason why I can't make gravy. Because I can't measure it right.
You don't have your grandmother's cup. Yeah, I think it's fascinating to see, because most of us before there were cookbooks, learned orally. You know, these were passed down recipes from our grandmothers and our moms who taught us how to cook. But new generations don't have a mom or a grandmother teaching them how to cook, or I don't have a Southern grandmother teaching me how to cook. And so in order to learn, we depend on cookbooks. And that is where our work comes in and why we take it so seriously, to measure, to test the recipes, to make sure that they are producible exactly as they are written, so we don't confuse you, to hold your hand while you're going through the motions of cooking without you feeling insulted, but otherwise feeling supported by us. It is really, writing cookbooks is a love language, like you said, Ryan. It is really a passion to bring others into the kitchen with us and open up the opportunities for you to succeed in doing the recipes and tasting the flavors that somebody else put on that plate together many, many years ago.
Sandra, your kitchen ghost.
I think one thing that people, when they're looking at traditional dishes and, oh, I wish, I wrote a book on cake, so people come and say, oh, I wish I had a recipe for this cake that my grandmother made. We never got her to write it down. And I say, you know what? Look at cookbooks from the time that your grandmother was cooking, and there will be a chocolate pound cake or a sonker or something. And your grandmother did not go in the kitchen like a chef and say, I'm going to come up with a new dish that's going to knock them dead at the Beard Awards. Your grandmother went in the kitchen and made chicken and dumplings or Hungarian goulash or tomato rice. She made the food of that time using those ingredients. And what you need to channel, which I think Crystal Wilkinson talks about so beautifully in this book, is you want to keep her alive and connect to her kitchen. So don't be cooking with a right, wrong, good, bad attitude. Be cooking with what is a way to bring the spirit of this recipe alive. People get so focused on what's written on that paper and right, wrong, good, bad. I think it's very sort of Western to say, who did this first and who does it best? And what I found in Thailand is that people talk about food and cooking all the time, sitting around having lunch, talking about what you had in the morning and what you're going to have in the evening. And there's lots of arguing. Ryan, have you heard any arguing about barbecue? What's right? What's wrong? What's good? What's bad? Oh, yeah. It can be kind of fun, but it's also better, I think, to focus on the stories. And it's not how much cinnamon did your grandmother put in that cake. It's how did it make you feel? What was it like when she brought it into a party? Getting the stories and then letting the food come from that with a sense of joy, not strict. It's not science.
Well, Ryan, any kitchen ghosts?
Oh, man. Listen, Ed Mitchell's Barbecue is 7 years in the making, and we probably could have used 8. All right, we needed all 7 years to finish this project. My grandmother's notoriously free-handed. The elders and the women of our church, notoriously free-handed. I say, hey, is there anything in here other than salt and pepper? She says, no. It's not. I say, Grandma, I can't write a whole cookbook with just salt and pepper. I said, what else is in this stuff? She says, love. I was like, I can't write a whole cookbook with 2 ingredients and love, okay? So, man, we got our team down and got our co-writer down, and we literally spent probably, a year and a half just following her around the kitchen and writing down what she was doing. And other elders, we went out to the community and other people that we trusted that were still cooking some of the things that we like, and we sat down with them. And we they were gracious enough to let us follow them and write down things. And we, fortunate enough, I had some things we had already written down from an old notebook from the restaurant that we still used. But for the most part, I didn't, and from the barbecue side, it was just like my great uncles and those guys. I mean, they're not going to tell you anything to make it look like you're better than them on the grill. Like, yeah, you sit out here by this fire for 49 days and then you'll know what all the ingredients are. I'm not telling you what they are.
Oh, right?
But it was really competitive and fun. But I think the blessing in all of it is really just understanding, wow, they made all of this great food with literally only a handful of you know, ingredients and stuff. You know, we live in a world now, for my generation, the hyperbole and the nuance that has to go into 100%. Making things sound way more and way better than what they are. We have to, you know, Instagram it up. But in, in reality, it's really only a handful of ingredients that they use to make things totally amazing, you know, but we can't sell that.
Well, think how hard it is to make biscuits. It's there. What, three ingredients? There's flour. There's some kind of fat. There's some kind of liquid. Yeah. There's salt. And yet, I can't write a recipe where anybody can go in the kitchen and do it the first time and come out with grandma. Grandma did it probably starting when she was 12 years old.
That's right.
And did it again and again and again. And there's a gift from that. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean don't start, but don't start to make it perfect. That's think about these. I mean, that research, you can go to a library and research. You did the heart research, and that would be lost if you hadn't done that. It's so moving.
That's right.
But I love the idea. Crystal's book is absolutely magnificent. She's a poet, too. So when you read her words, it's just delicious to read it. But I would say I love the idea of kitchen ghosts. I think my kitchen has like 200 of them yelling at me. But I love the idea of kitchen ghosts because we can't touch them. We can't see them, but we bring them back when we eat their food. And I think it's the only form of art that can do that. We can stare at a picture and see what a painter saw for 5 hours. But with a dish, we can actually go back generations and back and forth through time and bring those loved people or those people we never met back. And I think that's what makes cooking so special. So find your ghosts.
This reminds me of something I think about recipes. A recipe is not, it's not the Constitution, it's not the Bible, it's not a math test. It is a guide. So if you say, I want to go to Morganton, North Carolina, I'd say, well, you get on this highway and you do that or that. Or do you want a scenic route? Are you in a hurry? How would you go? I'm going to give you directions to go to that place. But that's not the only way to get there. Yes. And you may start out on the directions that I gave you, and the bridge is out. Wow. And there's a detour. What are you going to do? So when you're looking at a recipe, we've worked hard following grandma around, Zooming with 25 ladies, going back to Thailand and standing with a notebook. People thought, what is she doing? Yeah. It is coming up with a way to get you started. But when you are cooking, you have to make adjustments. There are things you don't have the same pan. Or I think people often say, well, I cheated and I changed something. And it's like, whatever my grandmother did, whatever we wrote down, she didn't always do it that way. If she was out of this, she would have done that. So make sure that you're coming in with that you're opening up your heart and thinking about how it becomes real to you. Because I don't think the ghosts are there to make sure that we do it the way they did. They're there to say, go on, don't give up.
I think we're trying to keep recipes alive by sharing a map for you to do it. But we actually want you to put your own spin on it and keep it going for the future generations. So one day they'll say, oh, grandpa used to put this in his pie, or grandma used to make tamales this way. So maybe we shouldn't only find our ghosts, but aim to become one.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I'm glad to have all of you on this panel. So you can correct me because I cheat all the time.
And cheat away. You have our blessing.
I was just so hungry the other day. I said, I'm going to fix some chicken and rice. So I like to fix rice. I mean, not minute rice. You know, the regular rice.
Rice, rice.
You have to stand there, make sure it doesn't stick to the bottom. And then this is how I cheated. I was like, you know, I think I have some old rotisserie chicken in the refrigerator. And then I was like, look at this limpo celery. So I got the celery, thinking of my grandmother, celery and some onions, and sauteed it in like butter and fixed the rice. And then the big cheat, the can of what? Cream of mushroom and chicken soup.
You're channeling my mother.
Mix that in there, threw the chicken in there, salt and pepper only, Ryan, in there.
That's it. That's all.
And I was like, yummy. You know, I don't have to, you know, go to Bojangles for dinner. You know, I was like, I'm going to fix me some chicken and rice. So maybe I'll make one of you all's cookbook. Because I don't measure anything. I don't know about these.
We have to. It's horrible to become a cookbook author.
It has to be.
You have to measure everything. It's like having a chemistry class. Everything has to be perfect. But that's not the way we cook on a regular basis.
I'm too free-flowing, as you can tell. So I can't do. So I have a question for Ryan.
Yes.
It says, I presume you tended the fire long before you were permitted to touch the meat. So what did you learn from watching as opposed to being taught?
Patience. You know, each protein has a different relationship with the fire, right? Your fish is going to cook different. Salmon is going to cook different than the chicken. The chicken is going to cook different than the pork. Pork is going to, the chicken breast and the half a chicken is going to cook different than the rack of ribs. But, you know, I was just putting everything on everything, you know, as an unattended kid, you know. So I thought that, you know, everything just came off when it was supposed to. But there's an internal clock that my dad and those elders and those guys had to know when everything was actually done, right? There were no thermometers. There was nothing to stick in to see what the internal temperatures were. It was all eyeball. And they ran a business on, you know, knowing that. And that's something you have to learn. That's something you just can't just go in there and just kind of just, you know, send out a bunch of half-done chicken inside the restaurant, you know, because you think it looks brown on the outside because you've glazed it with too much of the tomato base barbecue sauce with loads of sugar in it. So what happens? It's browned already on the outside because it's caramelized because of the sugar that's in the sauce. And you think it's done and you send a whole pan inside and it's not even, and that's a whole nother deal. You know, you ain't allowed to... You know, you're not even allowed to go back in there anymore. So, you know, those type of things, you know, were, you know, just understanding the relationship between the coals with and you know, the different sizes of cuts of meat that was on the smoker at the same time. There's a huge difference between indirect grilling and direct grilling. And that's something you have to kind of learn on the larger sets. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you've all diversified your careers with television appearances, teaching, and Ryan, in your case, and merchandising with your True Mate Foods sauce and condiments line. We have a question here that says, there is a YouTube channel named Pasta Grannies, an English woman. She went to elderly Italian women's kitchens and video the preparations of recipes that are not written down, but handed down. And this person asked, have you ever thought about doing something like that?
Yes. All throughout the book, I kept thinking that if you haven't seen Pasta Grannies, you're missing so much. 100-year-old women making their own type of ravioli filled with special capers from the mountain. I mean, it's just incredible. Yes, I would love to be able to show people cooking, because it's exactly what you were saying, Nancy. Everybody has their own touch, their own flavor, their own intonation that they give to a recipe. And to be able to see it, to visualize it, helps many people to learn how to cook.
Well, you know, guys, we have to wrap this up. I can't believe it. It went so fast. Well, many, many thanks to each of our guests today. Ryan Mitchell, co-author of Aunt Mitchell's Barbecue. Nancy McDermott, author, The Wok and Skillet Cookbook, 300 Recipes for Stir Fries and Noodles. And Sandra Gutierrez, Latissimo, Home Recipes from the 21 Countries of Latin America. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you for having us.
What a pleasure.
Well, this is Due South. Due South is a production of WUNC and a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Our producers are Stacia Brown, Codell Charco, and Rachel McCarthy. Denarius Thomas is our technical director. Aaron Kiever is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Quilla. Jeff DeBerry is my co-host. And a special thank you to Duke Campus Club and our audience gathered here today at Crosdale Country Club in Durham. This has been a multicultural Southern food experience. I'm Leonita Inge. Thanks.